Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead. It's a topic we cannot help but return to, making the world a better place. In times such as these, there seems to be a direct contradiction between the scale of potential global change and the difference one person can really make. In a brave and ambitious new book, ecologist and philosopher Timothy Morton confronts this head-on with a radical suggestion for how humanity can take it on. When you first hear about his ideas, some of them may sound bizarre. He argues that everything in the universe, from algae and rocks to knives and forks, has a kind of consciousness, that we need to scrap the concept of nature. He talks of hyperobjects, the internet, or climate change, for instance, that might seem abstract to us but are very real and can be treated as objects. And he says we're ruled by a kind of primitive artificial intelligence, industrial capitalism. These ideas might sound strange to start with, but sit down with Morton for 5 minutes and they start to make sense. His latest book, Being Ecological, explores all of these concepts in his unique style. And so, in that spirit, we begin this interview during the sound check. After Sian Kane has confessed that as someone who's never studied philosophy, she feared it would be a brain slog to get through his book. But she had emerged understanding and, in some ways, profoundly changed.
Oh my gosh, you did?
Yes.
Resolved.
Good.
Oh, that's so great. Oh, I'm good. Really, really pleased about that.
Oh, good. I'm glad I said it.
Oh my gosh.
So I was a bit embarrassed. I was a bit like, I don't have any philosophical education or anything, but...
You're talking to the right person here.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like I am.
Because I don't either.
Really?
You know, I'm one of these English lit professors who gravitated into philosophy world, you see.
Yeah.
And it was Gary Snyder who pointed out that I was a philosopher. I actually had his job. He retired from University of California, and for some reason I took his job. And he read this book that I did called The Ecological Thought, and because a friend of his gave it to him, and this friend was a colleague of mine, and it was told to me that Gary was like, wow, this is philosophy. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I never would have called myself it. It yeah. sounded too, it's sort of too ego trippy to call yourself that. And also, like, funnily enough, the more you hear it said of you, the more I feel like you probably should hear the words absurd clown. You know, like, that's what I hear when people say, oh, now, the philosopher, Timothy Morton. I say, oh, now, the absurd clown, Timothy Morton, will do absurd clowny things.
Perform for your audience.
Right.
I suppose, in that way, what is the role of a modern philosopher? Because it does feel almost very, you know, you align it with perhaps ancient Greece. And
right.
Rather than today. But where are you?
Well, you know, we're living in this time where automation is becoming more and more and more sort of prevalent. And I hear about it all the time. So everyone's really worried about robots and things and AI and all that kind of thing. And if you think about it, software is kind of some kind of human being's affect, emotion, thought, crystallized or calcified and then automated, right? Mm-hmm. So therefore, it's the past, right? It represents like a past state of some human being, right? Now, the trouble is that if everything gets more and more automated, it's kind of like the past with all of its patterns and whatever. Just think about Facebook and the fact that when I went to Google, I went to a room where there was 80 men and 3 women in it. It's kind of eating the future, right? Like the past is eating the future. And we've gotten very good at this sort of past eating the future as efficiently as possible. But the trouble with the past is it's got a lot of toxic social and whatever else chemicals in it that aren't so great for just take your pick, everybody except for white guys, and even then. And so, like, in a way, philosophy's never been more important, you know, precisely because social space is so preoccupied with making everything nice and efficient and kind of automating what's already going on. Like, think about the stock market. It's basically those algorithms that control it. are like human fear, mostly operating at like a nano speed, like the normal fear, but really, really fast and really, really efficient, and sort of like, how's that going to work out in the long term kind of thing? And sort of like, so in a way, most humanistic scholarship, in particular perhaps philosophy, is about like the future, not necessarily like specific predictions about the future, but like holding open the doorway for the possibility of something different. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And sort of like, I'm the absurd clown in the door, kind of holding it open, like, hey, look, there's a clown thing, you can go this way as well, you don't have to be in this pattern, you know. And sort of that's like my job, you know, like there's this big emphasis on STEM, right, you know, mm-hmm. science, technology, whatever, engineering, math, and the thing in your pocket can probably do calculations like that billions of times faster than my kid can do now. And it's like we're training these guys to do something that's billions of times slower than what's actually in our devices right now. And like, how is that actually equipping people for this automation age, right? By automating the kids, like mm-hmm. in a way, like the whole idea of teaching people sort of critical thinking and being able to sort of like see around the corners of their ideas seems like even more important than ever, precisely because we've gotten so good at like stacking the cups of this reality
yes.
really well.
Well, I mean, all of this fits in with a concept that you return to in a lot of your books, which is anthropocentrism.
Ooh, yeah.
About people, and yeah. that we are at the heart of all things, and whether yeah. that is correct or not,
right.
but that is
right.
a lot of how the world works,
yeah.
is that we believe we are
yes.
the most important thing on this
right
on this planet.
Yeah.
I mean, can you sort of explain a little bit more about what that term means, and
yes.
particularly in relation to the environment?
Right. Well, you know, it's this idea that I think you said it perfectly well.
Thank
you know,
you.
Like human beings are the top, and like human being things are like the top things. So, for example, thinking about stuff, in particular, you know, because we're all into like mathy, STEM-y type stuff from Kant onwards, it's all about measurement, right? So, like, the cup is yay big and it's traveling at yay velocity and it's got this mass and all that stuff. And that kind of information is much better than what my bearded dragon lizard does to the cup, which is lick it, right? But I actually personally think that a cup thought isn't a cup, and like a cup lick isn't a cup, and a cup drink isn't a cup. And if the cup were to become sentient for some weird reason and go on Oprah and do an interview about itself, what it would say would be cup interview, not cup,
not
right?
The
and
cup.
So, funnily enough, like thinking and licking and all that stuff equally don't quite access the entire Gesamtkunst cup, as it were, like the whole cup in itself, right? And so, funnily enough, once you've admitted that like licking is just as good or bad as thinking about it, you've sort of made it so that like lizards and tortoises and your own tongue can be just as important as thinking about it, right? And also, of course, your tongue, you know, it's like, is it really your tongue? It's made of all this kind of like evolution stuff that includes things like lizards and fish and stuff like that. And there's all this stuff inside of Tim, like DNA and bacterial microbiome and all that kind of thing that isn't Tim, you know. And so one really nice thing about ecological awareness is that it makes you realize that anthropocentrism is actually a really heavy sort of incorrect big deal that you're sort of imposing also on yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit less of Tim than he used to like to think, and so actually it means that there's like a bit more wiggle room for like Tim to do stuff he likes to think to himself, you know. And it's a little bit like, funnily enough, that line in Percy Shelley's lovely poem that Gandhi and King really like, called The Mask of Anarchy, which says, you know, what does it say? Rise like lions after slumber. And it says, ye are many, they are few, right? And sort of like, that's historically accurate. It's like politically a cool idea, but also, check it out, it's ontologically correct, right? Ontologically means having to do with how things exist, right? And how things exist is that there's so much more in them that isn't them. Like there's all these bits of cup and there's all these possibilities for like licking it and drawing pictures of it and like ignoring it and brushing it and stuff that aren't completely like to do with that cup.
And all those interactions are as valid as one
yeah,
another.
Yeah, right. For instance, we are human beings. You know, when I say we, it's very important all of a sudden to be like grasping that horrible word which most people think defaults to white guy underneath. But the human species did cause global warming, not like octopuses, right? And so it's sort of important to say we, but not in that enlightenment way where if you scratch the surface of anybody, there's like a white guy underneath.
You know?
Like everybody's really a man. Some of them are women, but that's okay. That sort of idea, right? And so if you think that actually there's a lot less of you than you think, and that actually your existence is more like a kind of weird sort of symbiotic heap of lots of things, including, you know, computers and iPhones and microphones and rooms and cars and carpets and stuff and sentences and ideas and all that, then there's non-human beings inside of you and around you and like enabling you, right, at the same time. And it's like a much, it's more like you don't have to make an effort to kind of deanthropocentrize yourself and kind of, oh, I have to do something really special now. You just have to notice something that's already true, right? And that's sort of like the spirit of this book. It's sort of like, stop trying to like do something impossible and jump into some impossible weird space that's really hard to understand. Just like notice something that's already there. You know, it's a little bit like how the current president of the USA, whose name I have terrible trouble actually saying, has this idea that people are about to accuse him of collusion, right? Now, collusion is not a legal term, right? And it's sort of like the more they say the word collusion, the more it becomes this weird, mysterious thing like insider trading that you can never prove, or is it in fact incredibly obvious that people have been like having doing things with Russians, right? And so it's sort of like that, right?
Yeah.
It's like you don't have to set the bar that high, right? This anthropocentrism stuff is a big drag, you know, and like being human totally means something really different from what we like to think it means. And I think you can say we in a way that's like non-racist and non-misogynist if you think this way, you know. And that would be good because personally, I feel really crushed and sort of lonely and lot of pain about the situation that we're in ecologically. And it would be nice to have some kind of collective sort of solidarity feelings with people.
Yeah.
Like what happened in this hurricane.
Oh, yes. Well, talking about the hurricane, I mean, I've got an example, I suppose, this morning that because a lot of your book is about not necessarily the usual approach for an environmental book, which is to just chuck facts and statistics and graphs at you and hope that you sort of understand the weight of the situation. And what your book says is we all understand the weight of this. We all have a general idea about what global warming is and what climate change is, what the ramifications of these things are. The problem is that we just don't know what to do. And half of that battle is just changing how we think about the world and where we are positioned, which is not that it's humans versus the environment. It's that humans are part of the environment.
Yes, absolutely. And it's sort of like how we talk to ourselves about it in a way isn't helping so great. I get paid to say really unacceptable things that insult people and upset them. I'm so sorry if I'm bothering anybody about this, but like, so I'm in this hotel right now and it's around the corner from heaven, you know, which is not that place, but up in the sky, but a nightclub owned by Richard Branson. And I used to be there in the late 80s. And, you know, of course, in that kind of situation, there's a very powerful strobes, right? And they kind of get strobed by these strobe lights and you're like, ugh. And in a way, that's sort of what we're doing in a funny way to ourselves with these headlines that go 25, 6, 500,000, 2%. And then there's another lot you got to absorb the next day. And it's like we're kind of strobing each other with these flashing lights so that we become this sort of deer in the headlights. Like, oh, it's like oddly enhancing the paralysis feeling, funnily enough. And this is exactly when not to be paralyzed. You know, so how to figure out like a more gentle way of talking might actually be way more effective, like not necessarily gentle in a namby-pamby way, but like more playful and curious and like therefore open to this idea that things might be different, you see? But how to not get stuck in tragedy mode, basically.
Well, I mean, this morning I bumped into a colleague of mine, Jason, who's been in Cape Town for the last few weeks, and he mentioned that there had been a problem with water there, which I actually hadn't heard about. And then I went and looked it up, and apparently after the last sort of 3 years in a row, they've had very dry winters, and the rain has been falling in places that it normally doesn't fall, which has led to their aquifers being dry.
Wow.
And Cape Town has now identified a day zero, which is the day they're going to run out of water, is April 16th, which is not very far away. We're sort of at the tail end of January at the moment when we record this.
Yeah.
And sitting here in London, it's a rainy day.
Yes.
I've got plenty of water in my home.
Yes.
but it's still terrifying to me that somewhere not that far away, this is going on.
Yes.
But what do I do about that? Because I do feel that paralysis that you feel, like I might read the news tomorrow to see if they move the day zero a bit further back, if they move it forward, but I don't know what to do with knowledge.
The trouble also is that the model we have for things that are that cataclysmic is some kind of religious apocalypse thing.
Yes.
And then when you can put an actual date on it, you know, like the people with the sandwich boards when I was a kid in Oxford Street, like, oh, so the end of the world will happen on the 16th of April. So like Arthur Dent in you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Actually, the world is ending for real physically now. And the way we talk about it, on the other hand, is like, we're going to go into this completely transcendental realm and the earth is going to be like ripped open and some amazing cosmic thing's going to happen. And what's really going to happen is some physical, tangible, real event that mostly is incredibly oppressive and very boring and might go on for a very, very long time and has nothing to do with like fireworks with Jesus popping out of them, you know. And so sort of like the kind of doomy, spectacular way that we're rubbernecking that as a kind of apocalypse is part of that paralysis feeling. And I know this because being in this hurricane, or actually tropical storm, you know, I like to think of myself as someone who loves to think about these things. It's, oh, yes, it's what I call a hyperobject and blah, blah, blah. But actually, like, experiencing it and undergoing it was incredibly embarrassingly difficult. And what I remember is that Hurricane Harvey unleashed Hurricane Tim, right? That's the problem with these events. They sort of unleash this kind of inner kind of churning because all of a sudden you're on hurricane time, or in this case, water loss time, and you're on some other entity's timescale, if you think about it. Here's this great big thing, like the worst, biggest, baddest mothership from some Independence Day-like film floating above Houston, about the size of whales, and it's scooping up water from the Gulf, and it's dumping it on Houston, and it's totally static, and it's like, what is it going to do next? And there was a headline in the paper about 3 or 4 days in that said something like, it's Wednesday in Houston, but no one knows what day of the week it is. And it's absolutely true. Everyone's like, what day is it? Because all of a sudden, you're not on Tuesday, Wednesday time, you're on hurricane time.
Yeah.
You know? Now, the advantage of this is that eventually everybody had some kind of realization that you might also have had if you've been in Heaven nightclub at some point, which is, oh, right, I get it. I'm on really, really bad acid. You know, it's sort of that feeling, like, I understand now. And that very next day, me and my friend went to the pub and we noticed that everyone was walking around in that kind of Glastonbury festival on the last day thing, but everyone's really blown open. Actually, no one cares. Like, I really don't actually care that you voted for that guy. I really don't care. You really don't care that I voted for that person.
Yeah.
And what do you need? And this kind of, I know it sounds really corny, but somehow it was achieved through this kind of collective experience. And I feel like that was the upside of it. Like, letting go of a certain kind of anthropocentric time frame where it's sort of like, well, it's Wednesday, things have got to happen. So actually, no, it's not. It's all kinds of different times, all interpenetrating. It's hurricane time and Houston time and Tim time and you time, and it's the 21st century, and it's, you know, all these different times. That's what ecological awareness is. It's like suddenly realizing there's all these different scales of time and space, and there's no top scale. There's no like one scale to rule them all. And so that's disorientating. And then at the same time, say, oh, actually, this is quite playful because you can sort of slip and slide between different scales. I'm going to do something on this scale now, and I'm going to do something on this scale. And one of the really cool things about it is you can know deep down, one message I'd like to send to people who are listening to this podcast is sort of like, you're not guilty. You are not guilty. You, and as an individual person, when you started your car or whatever, you didn't cause global warming. You so didn't do that. It's statistically meaningless, right? The paradox is that billions and billions of those things did do it. So on the one hand, like, I'm little Tim sitting here talking, and on the other hand, I'm part of this asteroid that's hurtling towards Earth at 30,000 miles an hour called the sixth mass extinction event. And it's sort of like, here we are sitting calmly in the room, and that's real. And here's this asteroid aspect of me, and that's real. And those two things don't actually cancel each other out. Right, like, of course, weather is a symptom of climate. I mean, there's no need to prove for one more second, like, was it caused by global warming? Well, yeah, because global warming is like the umbrella and everything else is happening underneath it. But then again, weather is so much more things than just a symptom of climate, right? It's this lovely bath for these toads that have come out in force because there's this hurricane. It's this weird, strange sensation on my skin that's actually quite pleasant. It's this funny thing that I'm using as an example of how there's plenty of wiggle room in life with my lovely interviewer in this podcast interview. It's all these other things than just being a symptom of global warming, right? And so actually, in the end, ecological awareness is, it's all right to like maybe the 50 dpi JPEG and then maybe the 3000 dpi. It's actually quite playful, and even maybe comedy is not quite the right word if you think it just means funny. But comedy is a mode that incorporates so many different emotions, like coexisting, almost like in a kind of nice ecosystem where nothing's really deleting each other too much, right? Mm. Tragedy mode is where you are rubbernecking one being, desperately trying to extricate themselves from their fate, only to find themselves doubling down on it in that very process. And it's as if you're exempt from it. You're sitting in the audience watching this kind of thing. It's like a religion thing. It's like, oh, look at that guy there. He's in trouble. But like, when you see lots of people doing it, it's called Fawlty Towers, right? Like, lots of people trying to, like, not be who they are, but actually being who they are in that moment is really funny, you know? And somehow that's where it goes to. Like, my friend Kim Stanley Robinson, the sci-fi writer,
Yeah. He
writes novels about global warming, and they're funny in the end because they're about this kind of chaotic mix of all these different emotions, you know, and emotions are real, just like cups and rain, and they can coexist too.
For people that perhaps feel like they are aware of their position in the environment and feel like they are ecologically aware, I suppose a lot of people out there at the moment in particular are feeling perhaps a bit defeatist about a lot of things that are happening in the world.
Yeah.
And you write in this book about being asked, what do we do though? And you say that you never really have a straight answer for this because it's not as simple as just, well, recycle a bit more, ride your bike a bit more, fly a bit less, that sort of thing. It's more about an abstract way of thinking. But do you ever have people respond going, but no, I want something concrete. Tell
Absolutely.
Me what concrete to do.
And you know what? And I have one. Here's one I made earlier because actually, you know, it's really flip for people like me to be like, well, you know, reflecting and thinking is also a way of doing things. And don't forget the Marxist notion of praxis, which is like theory plus doing stuff. And it's sort of like, yeah, that's like a real sort of cop-out in a way. There is something you can do, I think. First of all, I'm not a social policy person. There's an obvious thing to do. Completely stop carbon emissions and, you know, restructure society now, right? Then there's these other things you can do. And I think that's where I can come in, right? So, for example, one thing you can do is fight racism and misogyny with all of your might right now. Because actually, one thing that's keeping human beings from identifying with, like, the coral and the polar bears is, for instance, racism. Because I think that what people call speciesism, which is this anthropocentrism thing, which is like, I'm really different and special than these other beings, is actually enabled by racism. Because into this kind of what some people call this uncanny valley, in between me and the polar bear, the racist has trucked all of these sort of supposedly abject, inhuman, not right human beings, right, that then creates this kind of barrier between me and the polar bear. As soon as I can see that I'm also one of those uncanny beings, and the polar bear is also one of these uncanny beings, and everyone's sort of weirdly, slightly, twistedly, fragilely something. Am I human? I just like argued that I sort of slightly wasn't, right? And so I think, personally, if we're going to try to accelerate this thing, we should be struggling really strongly against racism and misogyny. And I'm right now, I'm one person away from David Attenborough, and I want desperately to persuade him to do something like you did with the plastic, only with race. Right, like, let's do this Descent of Man, guys. Let's look at whiteness and blackness. Let's do it. Like, that's a Darwin thing. That's an evolution thing. Darwin wrote that book deliberately to go up against this American racist biologist called Agassiz, who invented those stupid words that you still see on American forms, like Caucasian, bleh, vomit, you know. And all those things are deeply, you know, the technical term is teleological, right? And that's a big problem, and it's not correct. There's no point to evolution. It's really random, and it's really hard to get used to that, but it's much nicer than it having a point. Because if it has a point, it means that, you know, Aristotle used to say, Aristotle was Alexander the Great's teacher. Alexander the Great needed all kinds of reasons for invading places. So Aristotle was like, well, Greeks are for enslaving barbarians, and barbarians are for being enslaved by Greeks. QED, you know, and you've got your reason there, you know, to do it. someone like David Attenborough, with that kind of incredible reach and that sort of open, soft curiosity that he's got, could do this amazing thing for people that would get people to the let's help those melting ice cap polar bears much more quickly, mm-hmm. I think, than just going, polar bears, please think about the polar bears. Right, like you sort of skipped a step a little bit, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Do you think, though, that for some people, there are people genuinely out there that are motivated by things that are outside of this argument that it doesn't actually benefit them to not be racist, for example. And as long as you have people that think like that, things maybe won't be changed. Mm.
Well, yes, quite. And this is exactly why to struggle, you see, because clearly it's really not to their benefit. It's clearly the case that economically speaking, the places in America like Houston, that super almost post-racial city, it's the minority-majority shift epicenter, right, are doing so much better than these enclaves of whiteness economically, you know. And of course, actually, extreme right people have shame. Actually, they bloody well know that they're wrong. They know that people in San Francisco, London, New York, Paris have something correct going on about race and gender and stuff like that. Otherwise, they wouldn't be so upset. Like, a real fundamentalist really wouldn't care what other people thought. Like, they really wouldn't even be trying to impose their thing because they'd be so self-satisfiedly right, they wouldn't mind. They wouldn't need to do any of these marching things. So it's not true to say that these people are shameless, you know, that actually they have shame, and how to work with it and get them out of that stupid conceptual ditch that they dragged themselves and other people into.
And I suppose linking back to the environment, you have a line in your book, which I actually underlined because I was so interested in it, that you write, if you are committed to the reality of what human carbon emissions are doing, don't be so hard on deniers of global warming. Mm. Which, for a lot of people, that isn't a palatable thought because you think, well, some of these people are in power and they have a say over policy or resource distribution or how we tackle these problems. Mm. But can you sort of explain a little about why we shouldn't be?
Yeah. It's paradoxical, and again, you know, like I say, I have this weird curb your enthusiasm habit of saying exactly the wrong thing that shouldn't be said, and sort of like, I feel like it's a little bit my job, and so perversely I sort of do it, right? I'm certainly not saying agree with Exxon's, like, greenwashing of their incredible, absurd, stupid thing. I mean, I live in Houston, you know, I live in Mordor, you know. I'm planning a sort of disco on the ship channel. We're going to have this boat and we're going to have like decks and stuff.
Oh, really?
And we're going to like take heaven through the ship channel there with all the oil refineries. It's an absolute nightmare situation there. So I'm so not saying that's nice. You know, as one extraordinary, I don't know if I can say rude words on this podcast, but as one Buddhist teacher I know said once, you can't turn shit into chocolate mousse. I mean, it actually is shit, right? So I'm so not saying that. It's more like what I learned from Fun Boy 3 when I was a kid. You know, it's not what you do, it's the way that you do it, right? In a way, the how of how we go through this is the what. And the trouble with the way we talk to each other about global warming data is that it does, unfortunately, and I'm really going to say something that's going to really make some people angry, it is a belief war. It defaults to some kind of belief structure competing with another one, so that the quote-unquote denier thinks they've got to replace their belief with the other belief, right? So actually much better than waiting for the setup, the poor scientist who's like set up behind that table at the IPCC, who's never really done lots of critical thinking classes and doesn't know like the resonance of how they're coming across and stuff, automatically gets into that. And it would be more efficient in a way, like fighting racism and stuff, to have a conversation about belief. You know, like my son Simon, he was in the playground the other day and some guy came up to him and was like, do you believe in God? And he's like, no, actually I don't. And the guy was like, well, then in that case, I hate you and you can't be my friend, you know? Yeah. And I said to him, Simon, next time that happens, why not try this? Like, instead of saying yes or no, say, okay, well, before I answer the question, what do you think believe means? Let's have a conversation about the word believe. Because believe could mean like holding on for grim death to something that you know is right and you're going to defend it against stuff. Or it could mean, you know, and here's where Kierkegaard comes in handy, trusting, you know, like open, you know, like actually trusting something. And so, you know, clearly the belief mode that people are in when they talk about this is this kind of holding on way, which is identical to all the things that we had to undergo at university when somebody was trying to persuade us that the empty tomb was a proof that JC came back from the dead and all that stuff, and you don't accept it, you must be evil and blah, 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 blah. And it's sort of like how to transmogrify the way we do it, because that mode, which is like religion mode, has probably hoovered up as many people as it can hoover up, but there's all these millions of other people. And so, like, instead of doing this hoovering up thing, something else. So I know it's a bit funny, like, and to hear it, when I hear you read the sentence, I think, oh my God, really? I should sue myself. That's a really stupid thing to say. I'm so sorry. Should I just completely rewrite the book, actually?
Yeah, let's tear it up.
Yeah.
There's a striking line of hopefulness in all this, that it is possible for people to change how they think and to think about the environment in a very abstract way and to think about themselves in a very abstract way and consider down to the bacteria in them that yeah. actually gives them a lot in common with, say, an octopus or a polar bear or you know, anything in the environment.
Right.
How do you maintain that hope? Because a lot of people aren't feeling that hopeful at the moment.
See, the thing is, if you're in my line of work, what you've really got to go on, your lab, in a way, is your inner space. It's your emotions and your thoughts and your ideas. It's sort of what you're working on, right? It's sort of why I love doing dialogues and Q&A in this sort of situation, because I couldn't work without this kind of situation that we're in, because that's my lab. And part of inside of me is depression, actually. I'm very out about suffering from depression. I take antidepressants. And I really know how that mode is really toxic. It's sort of like, it's kind of like an allergic reaction of your intellect to the poor little you out of which the intellect came. And then the intellect is like the white blood cells, and the white blood cells are looking for anomalies, like, oh, that's a funny looking thing over there. And so's the intellect, like, oh, that's a funny little contradictory thing, I must eliminate it. And what could be more contradictory than funny old fragile broken you with lots of bits of bacterial DNA in you, right? And so eventually the logical conclusion of the depression is the suicide, which is like the anaphylactic shock. Like, if you don't take the steroid or whatever, you're going to have this horrible thing's going to happen. And so I'm terribly keen on not dying, you know, like I'm really like, and I feel like because of the situations I've been in, courage for me is like the number one top best emotion, you know, and sort of like the one that's guaranteed to make me sort of blub, you know, when I listen to music or see art or whatever. And I'm really determined to use that, like, to show people, like, this is actually, like, you really shouldn't go there, this isn't cool. Like, just because it's true that things are really messed up doesn't mean this other thing, like Blake poems. Some poems by Blake are like in invisible quotation marks, because they're actually like lies in the form of the truth. Think about the tiger, you know, tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. Basically, there's this horrifying tiger made basically of metal. He's like the T-9000 prototype, liquid metal, kind of Terminator kind of a guy, right? And the person who's talking about this is like, how could God have created this Terminator evil being, you know? And the whole point is, true, there are tigers who can eat us. It's actually an ecological fact. It's like there are diseases and sharks, and in any system there's going to be some dodgy thing that's going to like try to kill you or whatever, or you're going to try to kill it, you know. But it's how you think that, right? And how the speaker in the poem is thinking it is, I'm a stupefied rubbernecker of the almighty power of this omnipotent God underneath whom I'm totally crushed. How empowering is that? Not at all, right? And so, like, while it's true that there are these horrible things going on, mass extinction, I can't even think about it for more than 1 second without wanting to go into the fetal position. I mustn't, because if I do, then I'm so not helping. And so how to help people have this courage to think on this? You can't delete the fact that you know that some of global warming is going to still be around 100,000 years from now. This is like crazy. And it's even worse, it's not infinity, because infinity makes you feel all cool, like, ooh, look, I'm bigger than the universe, you know. But 100,000 is, oh my God, I can't even count up to 1,000. I did a dissertation at Oxford, you had to write 100,000 words. Oh, you can't do that all in one go.
Yeah.
You know?
In our conversation today, we've brought up Blake, we've brought up so many things from pop culture, Terminator. Mm. In your book, there's a lovely description of the Uncanny Valley involving R2-D2. In Dark Ecology, actually, you had a really great analogy involving Blade Runner, which I really liked. That the idea of Deckard having this realization that perhaps he is also the enemy that he is Vincent out to find. Humans are realizing that we are actually the cause of the problem that we are trying to fix.
Yeah.
I mean, how does art and pop culture and everything feed into your philosophy? Because, I mean, you, famously, this is a thing that I think gets said about you a lot, is that you're friends with Björk.
Yeah, yeah.
And your theory of hyper-objects.
Yes.
Is it actually related to her song Hyper Ballad?
Of totally.
Really?
Yeah. It's the same number of syllables, and sort of like someone was like, oh, we got it from mathematics. I was like, oh, really? There's a hyper object word in math? Oh, no. No, it just sort of popped in my head because I'm a big fan of that tune. What about every single styrofoam cup ever? You know, I was writing this book called The Ecological Thought. I was like, how do you describe things at that scale? Pollution that's going to go on for thousands and thousands of years. So that hyper, because it's kind of beyond, an object, because it's an object. Ooh, hyper object. Ooh, what's that? It's like television. It's like really this kind of widescreen word, you know, and it's sort of intriguing looking, and it's like Greek and Latin sort of stuck together. And I was the first person to think, oh, my goodness, what the hell is a hyper object, actually? I think I better find out. And so, yeah, I do think through art. I do. And I don't make much of a distinction between whatever, like, arty art and poppy art or whatever.
Sort of highbrow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, my comfort zone at home is stupid sci-fi, you know. But, like, art is from the future. I know it sounds really silly, weird to say that, but art, even more than, like, philosophy's holding open the door for the future, and art is the door. Art's the thing that's coming through the door. Because if you think about it, this poem that we're reading, whatever it is, it's got these words in it and these rhymes and stuff. And these all represent decisions that were made by somebody or something. I don't know what. The author, the author's unconscious, the family, the economic system, the ecological whatever at the time. I don't know. All these things represent states of the past, right? But what does the poem mean, right? And what is this poem? There's a kind of not yet feeling about that. A little bit like you can't really know what the end of the sentence is going to be. Elephant, banana, sausage, period, right? Like you can never really know that in advance. And so in a way, art is the future. Like actually everything is the future. Microphones are the future. But in our culture, we let art be that place where the sort of, to use a nice word, the futurality of things can kind of like beam down into whatever the present might be. And so I always feel like when I'm working with art or with artists, it's not me like mansplaining it. It's more like the art is artsplaining Tim, right? Sort of that way, right? So it's like telling me how to think because it's from the future.
I suppose on that, and you're a philosopher, so you understand the world in terms that perhaps the average person may not have read Heidegger or a whole bunch of philosophers that of the theories that you will refer
good
back
for them.
To. But it feels like you have a lot of joy in sort of drawing on pop culture to talk about philosophy. You never feel frustration that you can't go back to this sort of very rich language of philosophy to just explain it on its own terms and not have to refer to these sort of things that everyone knows?
Ah, well, that would imply that I'm using the art as a kind of PR or as a kind of hundreds and thousands candy sprinkles to put on top of a pre-existing idea.
So making it a bit tasty.
Yeah, but
a
funny... Yes, exactly. But actually, even in my philosophy, I don't believe that things to do with appearing, which is what art is all about, are secondary or superficial to these kind of lumps of unformatted stuff. I think how things appear is deeply intertwined with what they are. And so therefore, actually, I'm really, really saying that sometimes the truth is not in the kind of pre-formatted conceptual emoji that you get from the philosophy. There's so much of that going on in so many different ways in our culture, not just in philosophy world, but in, you know, editorial world and newspaper article world and radio piece world. Like there are so many ways in which that's true, you know. And so it's not like, oh, I've got this idea, let's try and find a way to illustrate it. It's more like, I'm really puzzled by why I'm so taken with this particular mix of, there's one particular 12-inch remix of Hyper Ballad, for example, by Beaumont Hannant. I find it really, really special, and I sort of think about it, and then the idea comes. It's sort of that way round.
Timothy Morton speaking there with Sian Kane. His book, Being Ecological, is out now, published by Pelican. Next week, Wendy Mitchell treads new ground with her memoir, Somebody I Used to Know, the first to be written by a person living with dementia. She joins us with her ghostwriter, Anna Wharton, to discuss the challenges and importance of catching memories, even as they slip out of one's hands. Meanwhile, there are thousands of podcasts in the Guardian archive on politics, science, technology, global development and more. You can find them all at theguardian.com/podcasts. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.